You know, sometimes life hands you oranges, but this morning, on Dave's Gone By, life has handed us a lemon. And yet, that is not a bad thing. You know, I always apologize for these terrible, terrible intros, but they're so apt, because we really, really do have a lemon with us, but a very, very special one. He is Chris Lemon. He is a writer. He is an actor. He is a musician. And he is also the son of a very famous and beloved performer himself. So please welcome to the neighborhood, Chris Lemon. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for having me on.
I guess we'll start, first of all, with the music and the fact that you're doing a cabaret show. And it is called A Twist of Lemon, but really it's a twist of two lemons, you and your dad. Why don't you explain?
Yeah, indeed it is, Dave, and it's kind of exciting. It's not a cabaret show, but I'm going to be playing for the first time a cabaret room, and I'm really very excited to see how that works out.
Okay.
This show was basically kind of the evolution of the book I wrote back a few years ago, which was written in my attempt to find a catharsis to deal with my father's death. And my dear wife, Gina, came to me and said, you know, you have to record the music that you've written over these many years. And so I did, and it suddenly occurred to me that the music was sort of a story itself, and that story wove in very nicely with the story I'd written in the book to create this sort of wonderful journey of father-son, a unique yet in very many ways universal father-son journey. And I just couldn't be more pleased with the way the pieces turned out. And I think it's going to be a little bit of a different type of fare than most people are used to seeing in a cabaret room in New York, because it really is a combination of a number of piano pieces, original piano pieces, mm-hmm. and this narrative of my father's and my life together and the wonderful times we had. I hope everybody enjoys it.
How would you say that the music itself weaves into? I mean, are these pieces that you have created thinking about the legacy of your dad, or are there some that you wrote with him or while he was still around?
No, these are all my piano pieces.
Right, yeah.
They were written at different points in my life, and they really kind of represented what was going on in my life. I do write in a sort of impressionistic form, and they represent what was going on in my life and happened to be sort of those things I couldn't say with words, couldn't express with words, that were fairly profound memories. The whole show is really based around memories, those wonderful things that most of us are fortunate enough to keep. They exemplify a number of the memories that I just couldn't express with words. And then those ones that I do express with words make up the other side of the narrative. So you might call it almost a dual narrative, telling the same story, which I've kind of found to be very effective. And so far we've had a number of performances, and the feedback's just been, it's just been wonderful. There's no water coat hangers in this story. I adored my father. But there were some tough times, too, and we talked about all of that. But it's sort of a wonderful ride through mine and my father's life. And I think very original in that aspect. And it's a very experimental idea to give it a shot in a New York cabaret room and see if, you know, audiences respond to a different kind of program.
At the risk of seeming a little bit like it isn't enough that you're just telling the stories and playing some of your own music, are you going to be having a slide or a PowerPoint with pictures and images as well, or clips or any of that?
We actually have a really very effective one. It's a lovely slideshow, and at the very end there's a wonderful clip of Shirley MacLaine and I performing a duet for my father at the AFI Tributes. It's a really wonderful part of the show. However, I really do think that independent of the slide show and the movie, that the show will work just fine, because we do want to have kind of an intimate one-on-one thing between me as the performer and the audience. This is a heartwarming story. This is one of those ones where you're going to get a chuckle and maybe a little tear in your eye, too. And there's not too many of those around these days. And I think with all the tough times we're all going through, that, you know, maybe people will enjoy hearing something that's a little bit uplifting and hopefully heartwarming for them.
Well, actually, also, if this project goes forward, you're going to owe yourself some royalties because you stole your own title, A Twist of Lemon. People should know is the name of the autobiography that you wrote about you and your dad back in 2006.
Yeah.
I finished reading it. It's quite enjoyable, although I start to wonder if half the songs that you wrote were basically around golf and fishing. And
No, this is the story of me trying to answer that one question I was asked my entire life and never could, which was, what is it like to be Jack Levin's son? And I think that it's a pretty tall order for anybody to answer that question. I mean, what's it like to be Harry Kunfors' son? Yes. How do you answer that? There's really no basis for comparison. But, admittedly, my situation was somewhat unique because of his superstardom. But he was such a wonderful and warm and engaging and witty and emotionally generous man and just such a true joy to be around. So, of course, there's that side of it. I have so many wonderful stories, a lot of which you read in the book. On the other hand, I was a child of a divorce, and Hollywood, when you reached a stardom at that level, really put a hammerlock on you and demanded your attention 110% of the time. I wasn't a really welcome entity in my father's second marriage, his house, which happens so often. That's the kind of universal side of the story. You know, the son from the first marriage seems to be, quite frankly, ostracized a great deal of the time in the second marriage, and I know that was the case with me. So there's those two sides of the coin. But the real guts of the story were the fact that despite this separation that occurred earlier in my life due to divorce and due to being a stepchild in the true sense of the word in my father's second marriage house, we decided we were going to fight against that. And there's a wonderful arc of the story where, as I say in the end, we became the best of friends against all odds. And, boy, I'll tell you, if there's ever been a time in America's life right now where we're all trying to be whatever we're trying to be against all odds, that's it. And so I think for that reason and many others, people will find it a very relatable and identifiable and believable story, despite the fact that we're talking about Jack and Chris Levin.
Do you think it would have been different? I mean, a lot of the book has to do with childhood and these wonderful memories of yours growing up, and so career didn't enter into it that much on your side. Do you think your also becoming an actor was a help, a hindrance in that relationship, and also was being his son a help or a hindrance to you in your acting career?
Well, honestly, I don't think that it made that much difference in our relationship because Pop has always been a very independent and somewhat private about his whole his career and his method of work. So whether I chose that or not, I don't know how much difference that made. Again, I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't. All I know is it was inevitable. I did my very best to become a lot of other things aside from becoming an actor, but it was sort of written in the genes, as they say. It was just what I ended up doing, and that's the way it was. I mean, I've even went so far as to try to become a classical pianist. I graduated from California Institute of the Arts with a BFA in classical piano and composition, and promptly started to get gigs as an actor. So it is what it is. Did it help or hinder me in my career? No, it's a difficult one, and there's a few people that handle it very well. Michael Douglas is one, Jeff Bridges, of course. But I think a lot of the fact that I had a pretty powerful force working against me in my father's second marriage, and it made it very difficult for him and I to have to be close about it, and B, for me to have those blessings, because there was that kind of person in the other camp working against me the whole time. That being said, hey, I never did turn out to be Jack Lemmon by any means, but I had a really tidy and very nice career. It did quite well by myself, and then decided to take some time off to raise my kids and investigate this world of writing and producing, and that was the number one thing. We have three incredible kids for it, and I've come up with a couple of projects, three projects that I'm extremely proud of and always will be.
Cool. I have to ask, because certainly your autobiography is not any kind of wire hanger tell-all thing. And it really barely ever gets nasty about anything or anybody. But you can, I mean, even on this, in this conversation, there's a sense that, the other camp, that other person, Have you had a reaction from your stepmom? Do you have any kind of relationship with
her? Unfortunately, we don't have a relationship. I hate to say it, but it's true. Unfortunately, not many people have a relationship with her. But mm-hmm. this is the one thing I acknowledge the truth of my journey and all of the components of it. Mm-hmm. There is no hash slinging in this. So I really have to, on that aspect, say I think I handle it in a very classy way. I tell the story truthfully. But I prefer not to comment off stage about our relationship.
Fair enough, or lack thereof, as you make clear. You appeared in 3 films with your dad. I thought it was only one. I thought That's Life, the Blake Edwards film. But IMDb does not lie, and it says you were in 3. What was that like? Were you intimidated, or was it just like, oh, you know, cameras are rolling, but I'm just acting with my dad, you know?
Well, it was good fun. I mean, obviously, the first Airport 77, I didn't even know what happened in Airport 77. I suddenly showed up on the set one day, and the director, was it Jay Sandrich? I'm not Ooh. Sure. It's just turned to Jack and goes, "Hey, you know, we're missing a guy. It's a little bitty part, but we're missing a guy to do just sit in front of an oscilloscope and say some lines. And why don't you let Chris do it?" And Bob said, "Sure." And so I sat down there and did that crazy little part. It's what got me my SAG card.
Oh.
So, you know, I have to say, yeah, it was really very cool. But there was, you know, I mean, there was no guts to it or anything. That's Life, on the other hand, was a fascinating experience. We adore Blake and Julie. They've always been like family to us. Blake Edwards, who directed, and Julie Andrews, his wife, who starred in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Blake just suddenly decided he wanted to make a family movie. And so both the Lemon Clan and the Edwards clan showed up along with a bunch of good friends like Bobby Loggia and Sally Kellerman, and we had no script. There was you're literally looking at a 2-hour feature motion picture that was totally unscripted. Everything was ad lib. Well, obviously, as soon as my father and I realized that was the case, we started writing ourselves a 35-page monologue, being good lemons. And we just had a ball. It was just such a wonderful experimental and just sort of a revel in each other's love for each other experience. And
there was a little bit of healthy competition too at times. Like when you would get a TV series, and suddenly he would let you pick up the check.
Right. Well, exactly. The father-son relationships, I say right off the top in the book, I say in the show too, is it's an enigmatic thing, not just on the surface, but deeply underneath. I mean, it's loving, yet it's competitive. You know, it's inclusive, yet at the same fact, it's judgmental. It's a really fascinating thing, and it's something I explore much more deeply in the book because I have the time frame to be able to do it, and that I also hint at very, very strongly and work with throughout the narrative of the show as well. But obviously the show, you know, we want this thing to be, you know, to be a hard-hitting and fun and full of laughter thing. So, you know, looking at a 75, 80-minute show as opposed to a 400-page book.
Of course.
But the real themes that I wanted to get at were it's a unique father-son relationship. Yes, he's Jack Lemmon. Yes, I'm Chris Lemmon. But it's universal in so many ways. So much of the stuff that I say was true about my relationship with my famous father and me being a somewhat famous actor myself. I've had guys come up to me from Tulsa, Oklahoma when I was doing the book tour and say, you know, it was the same way for me. I find that really very fascinating. And another one of the very important subjects I deal with in the show, even more so than in the book, is loss of innocence. I've always found the whole philosophy around loss of innocence and how it seems to happen in our world and to us really very fascinating, and that plays a big part of the show as well.
Well, one of the framing devices, the main framing device of the book, is that it's taking place, you're looking back, but as your father was dying of cancer. And so that is also a very universal thing, and to go through that, I mean, yeah, there's the gratitude of having him for X amount of years and having a mostly really good relationship with him, but at the same time, the sense of unavoidable loss. He's not going to get better. And that stretch of time where it sort of drags on and it becomes weaker and weaker. I mean, that's a hell of a thing.
Well, it's also when you've lost your second parent. I think has a lot to do with it as well. I know my dear sister Stephanie just lost her father, who was my father, Cliff Robertson, this last weekend, and we both lost our mother before that. And it's when you've lost the second one suddenly, and I think it was for her, you know, with her mother, with her father, very similar for me with mine, even though she's a girl and I'm a guy.
Right.
But, and I can't speak exactly for her, but I know she was feeling that. But for me, it was really like, suddenly, you know, because my mother, you know, the mothers, especially when there's a divorce early on for a son, they're the ones who stay home, put the bandage on the cut, you know, pack the lunch every day. They're the ones doing all the heavy lifting. But every once in a while, the father comes wandering in the door with, you know, with a present under his arms, and it's like God has arrived.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that's a difficult thing, and to have, you know, and to have a mother who is magnanimous enough to be able to deal with that situation, you know, hats off to them. But with my father, when he passed, it was literally like that hand, that gentle hand soft on my shoulder, that had not been pushing me, but had been gently reassuring me as I chose my different paths in life, was gone. And it left a resultant emptiness and aloneness. It was a very difficult thing for me to deal with. So what I did was, as I sat by my dying father's side, I just remembered all the good times and the bad. And I suggested this to my dear sister Stephanie. She tried as well. But after he was gone, I started writing those memories down one by one by one in a search for a catharsis. And it worked. But the catharsis, of course, was only temporary. It only really worked during when I was in the act of writing. And eventually I realized I'd written a story that might be worthy of being told, and that I need to become a book that's worth publishing, because I felt obligated to share that story. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. And maybe it's my own little sort of psychological addiction, but you know, every time I went on a book tour and was able to talk about it, and I always that hand seemed to be kind of back on my shoulder again. And when Gene and I together kind of discovered the spine of this show and how to make this whole idea work, I was really very so excited, because now it's happening again. And I found myself, we just did a show Saturday night, a wonderful audience, and it was just, there's such a warm feeling inside as I'm performing the show. And I think that the audience feels it, and I get that back from them as well. And afterwards, they all come up with tears in their eyes and give me a hug and say how much it meant to them to hear these stories that at once were a glimpse of wonderful Hollywood when it was really at its height, but at the same time, you know, a faithful recounting of a father-son relationship and friendship.
Well, Kim, would you mind sharing, Chris Lemon, one of the stories in the show? It can be a cute one, a poignant one, whatever, just to give us a taste of the kind of tales... Yeah.
What aspect? Which aspect of our relationship? Because, like any good relationship, it covers some pretty serious ground.
Well.
You know, I mean, I could sit here. I you know, there's one story I tell in there that I think is really the most indicative of what the book is about, which is my attempt to answer what it was like to become Jack Lemmon's son. But I'm a little reluctant to paraphrase it, only because it wrote so well, and the reading of it is kind of what it's all about. But it you know, to capsulize it, it was basically my journey through life, and the fact that as a kid and adolescent and even young adult, you have to realize being Jack Lemmon's son is exactly that. You are Jack Lemmon's son. You're not Chris Lemmon. You are an object, and not a being. And so finding your own self-identity can be an even more perilous trip than it would normally be. And that was, of course, the case for me. I tried to come to terms with being Jack Lemmon's son. And as I went through the journey of my life, there was, you know, I looked at my own fallacies and difficulties in dealing with that, like trying to be the center of attention at all at any times, so I could get that kind of gratification that, yes, Chris Lemmon does exist, I'm not just Jack Lemmon's son, was a very difficult journey. And then finally, you know, towards the end, I started to come to terms with it and achieve a nice degree. It's a tidy little career for myself. I remember at one point I was doing a pretty popular show. It was one of the five shows that actually launched the then brand new Fox Network. It was called Duet. And it had a very nice following. And I was out with my father at a mall. And for some very strange reason, I mean, I was getting hit on right and left for autographs. Not a person in the place was paying any attention to Pop. And, you know, he was handling it with his usual one-liner dignity by saying, you know, yeah, yeah, over here, sweetheart, big movie star. Finally, he came over to me, gave me a clap on the back, and said, all these years of being Jack Lemmon's kid, now it's who's the old fart with Chris Lemmon.
Oh.
And, yeah, it was just such a wonderfully endearing and wonderful moment, and I realized he'd gotten it all along, but it was something that I had to figure out for myself. And I wrap up the story by saying, and after all these years of, hey, aren't you Jack Lemmon's kid? Now, when I'd finally like to hear it more, I'm hearing it less and less. Mm. But isn't that just the way it goes? Fortunately, the wonderful thing is, for all of us out there, we'll always have those great movies.
Of course.
Some Like It Hot, and Mr. Roberts, and Save the Tiger, and Gary Glenn Ross, and of course, Grumpy Old Man.
Right.
And, you know, he'll live for us forever. And as my final line in the story is, and quite frankly, these days, if somebody was to come up to me and say, hey, aren't you Jack Lemmon's kid, not only wouldn't I mind, I'd be grateful.
Wow. And we are grateful to be talking to Jack Lemmon's kid, a.k.a. Chris Lemmon. Do you have another couple of minutes to stay with us?
Sure, of course. Oh, cool.
Because I did have a few other questions. Certainly, since you brought up all those movies that he was in, did he like seeing himself on screen? Could he watch his old movies? Or would he not be happy and he's, oh, I should have done that scene better?
No, he adored watching himself on screen. Are you kidding me? He was, you know, and I love the fact that he used to also, at screenings and stuff, he'd sneak in the back so he could watch people's reactions. He was, I think, pretty self-analytical, but always very comfortable with the end result. And I think Pop realized how blessed he was to work with wonderful people as well. I mean, you know, even his one of his first biggest films was with Billy Wilder as his director. His first two films were with wonderful Judy Holliday and the marvelous, and I tell a great story about George Cukor, who was such a great character and such a wonderful talent. You know, so he was really blessed with, A, having a wonderful instinct and making a lot of very, very good decisions on what to do and how to do it in his career, and also, B, for just being able to surround himself with the best and just have a wonderful jam session with them. You know, I mean, you know, how can you not point a finger at Walter Matthau when I say that?
Of course, of course.
Walter Matthau, I wake up in the morning, there's little notes on my pillow, say, we're out of cornflakes, and you. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F you meant Felix Unger. But, yeah, so there you go.
The interesting story that I remember from the book is not a happy one, but the idea that Jack Lemmon's single greatest moment on film wasn't captured on film, and so it became the second greatest moment when he was in the days of Wine and Roses. Can you tell that story real quick?
Isn't it? Yeah, he basically, the greenhouse scene where he goes looking for his bottle of booze and that he stashed someplace and he can't remember where he stashed it, so he just trashes the entire greenhouse. And, you know, Pop being Pop, he went for it to, you know, hook, line, and sinker and just went, you know, just went berserk on the place. Blake Edwards directing that film. And finally just, you know, Blake said, cut, we've got it, great stuff. Pop went home, he tells the story to me that he really truly felt it was the best work he'd ever done. Hit the hay, got a great night's sleep, woke up, hopped in his car for the next day of filming, showed up on the set, and there was the greenhouse all set back up again. He said, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Looking at the crew, and nobody would talk to him. They're all kind of doing that shuffle by, stare at the ground thing, and possibly, hey, guys, what's going on here? And finally, Blake came up, put a hand on his shoulder, and says, Jack, we lost it last night in the dark room. You know, we lost in the developing room. And that was back when they used film. And we got to do it again. So what you see, the take you see in Days of Wine and Roses was take two. And Pop said he never did it quite like he did the first time. But obviously, the second.
was good enough, certainly. Do you have the memories of the Matthaus and the people like that who were
constantly... Yeah, I do a whole section on Walter Matthau in the show. He was everything you would hope he would be, just like Papa, on screen and off. He was delightful, delicious, wonderfully irreverent. You know, I mean, I think I tell five or six Matthau stories in one of the sections. One of my favorites I'd forgotten about and a friend reminded me of, which was when my father was accepting an award from the American Heart Association. And he decided to have Walter come along. And Walter got up to say a few words, and all he said was, "Lemon's favorite food, a bacon cheeseburger, fries, and a chocolate frap. Enough said."
You're pretty good at this impression thing. You get the
essence. And you're a very good Walter Matthau.
Yeah, and what really shocked me a few minutes ago was just how good the lemon your father was. That moment that when you tell when he
talking about my dad.
Yes. And well, especially when he told the story about in the mall when people were recognizing. And he went into that whistle, and I was like, oh wow. That was really close. That was kind of a shiver sort of thing. But
lemon doesn't fall far from the tree.
Ba-dum-bum. So, now that you're doing the music, you're also a producer, I believe, a film, right? How do you divide your time most of your days? I mean, do you compartmentalize, or does part of the week involve
the
work?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just ecstatic to be involved in the business in any way I can at all times. I adore it. We have taken a hiatus from it, my wife Jean and I, to come to this beautiful place we live in and raise our beautiful children. You know, and now our children are at the point where you know they're ready to go off on their own, and I'm really ready to jump back in head first into the business. And the way I'm going to do that is to bring myself back in with a project that I've created. You know, it's just so brutal out there right now. That's the way I think is the smartest way to come back into the business. And I couldn't be more excited to be doing it than with this show. I truly think the show is worthwhile. It's got a wonderful message. It's got something to say. And I'm just so proud to be able to do it. And I'm really hoping it turns people on, because I'd like to do it for a number of years to come.
Well, it sounds really wonderful. I hope you'll be bringing it to Colorado, or at least bringing it back to New York when I can see it. But again, reminding people a few things. First of all, you can get a copy of A Twist of Lemon, still in bookstores, I assume. Do you have a website where people can get stuff of yours?
Sure, yeah. You can go to my website, which is stonemanorproductions.com, S-T-O-N-E-M-A-N-O-R, productions.com. There's a link to buy the book there. And, I think it's still in stores. I'm not sure. It's you can also get it from Amazon or one of those. Probably easiest just to go to my website.
And also, let's see, so they can also see you tomorrow night, Sunday night, 7 o'clock at the Metropolitan
right.
Room. Do you have music of yours, for say, is there a CD or any of that?
Yeah, Chris Lemon Music. You can go and buy the CD.
Cool, Chris Lemon Music. And keeping busy. Now, last question for Chris Lemon. Of your three children, do any of them want to be actors?
Yeah, Sydney is at her final year, and was on the dean's list last year, and I'm so pleased to say, and just she's so good, she's so talented, so industrious, she's just doing all the right stuff, and now she is starring in the big senior production at her university. She is just showing every single aspect that she needs to have in order to have a wonderful career in this business. I'm so excited for her. My middle son, Chris, is really fascinated by the whole tech side. Is a fabulous engineer, focusing on sound engineering at this point, and I think he's probably going to move on to stage management and ultimately producing. But right now, he's focusing on that. And there's a number of wonderful schools. His next year starts college that are very interested in him for that very reason. And right now, my youngest son's is the numero uno jock. So,
a jock is in not a radio jock, but jock is in sports.
He's an athlete, and I don't know. I'm starting to smell some nice scholarships coming up. So dad's really happy about that.
Can we have one last lemon memory? Maybe something that isn't even in the show, or it can be. But one last little Jack Lemmon moment from Chris Lemmon about him or both of you.
Well, let's see. I think one of my very favorite ones was when the dogs would escape. We had two standard poodles, and for some reason they just really loved to rub salt in the wounds by taking off. Pop and I used to love to jam and play the blues, and we'd do it all the way into the wee hours of the night. And as we did so, we might be known to take a little bit of the W.C. Fields call it the dram of the elixir pine tar and nicotine. and then the dogs would escape, and we would have to go out and find them. And Pop had this thunderously large old Mercedes-Benz 600 sedan, which was just, it was like just a huge floating brick. And we used to go out combing the neighborhoods with me sitting on the hood, hollering out, Walter, Virgil, Walter, Virgil, Walter, Virgil, while Pop drove around very ponderously. And finally we realized that they'd trespassed onto James Coburn's property. So we decided we were going to go in, commando style, and find them. And that actually ended up resulting in the two of us falling into a pond. I mean, you have to understand Pop was, what he was like in the films. He was just like that out in real life as well, and so was I. So falling into ponds and tripping through cactus gardens, and we finally found ourselves a complete mess with our arms around each other, looking at each other and going, those little sons of bitches are fast. And suddenly we realized somebody was staring at us about 2 in the morning. So we slowly turn around, and there he is, Mr. Coburn, all 6'4" of him, in some remarkable Afghan robe, standing in this huge picture window, just staring at the two of us. And there was a beat, and then there was two beats, and then both of us pointed at each other and said simultaneously, it's his fault.
Oh,
there you go.
I'm so glad I asked. That's wonderful in the book, but even more wonderful vocalized by Chris Lemmon. Do go get the book, and do, Mr. Lemmon, have more life and more music and more writing to do. Give that to all of us. I think there's a lot more to say from you, both of the past and of your future.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. You're a champ, and it was a lovely interview. Nice talking with you.
Very nice talking to you, too, sir. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.